Talo Falava, you're listening to Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koroy Hawkins. Coming up...
So you've lost young people, we have lost a lot of senior citizens, and it's very tragic.
The suffering continues in Fiji as COVID-19 cases soar amid ongoing calls for a nationwide lockdown. There are mixed reactions in French Polynesia to the French President Emmanuel Macron's visit.
That the Australian government, you know, was responsible for establishing the detention centre and was responsible for what happened inside there.
And the parents of an asylum seeker murdered in Australian offshore detention on Manus are suing the Australian government for negligence. In Fiji, the suffering continues as COVID-19 cases soar amid its worsening health crisis. There's been record daily case numbers, which has led to new curfew hours for the nation's main island of Viti Levu. Meanwhile, despite New Zealand's responsibility to support its neighbour, Jacinda Ardern says she cannot influence the Fijian government to go into a lockdown. Alicia Foon has the details.
A nation in crisis, with no end in sight. COVID-19 cases in Fiji are escalating, and so is the suffering. COVID patients are spilling out of hospitals, schools and churches, with symptomatic people being told to stay at home. Sashi Kiran, director of Friend, an NGO in Fiji, says people are heavily relying on groups like hers for food and medicine.
There's a lot more exposure because people are encouraged to get out and about for economic activities. We probably need to really shut down for a couple of weeks. We've lost young people. We have lost a lot of senior citizens, and it's very tragic. Everybody in Fiji now knows somebody who's died of COVID.
Fiji now has more than 18,000 active cases in isolation and 195 deaths. 193 of them from the latest outbreak. But the death toll and some of those figures are being questioned. 101 deaths have been linked to pre-existing medical conditions, despite them having COVID. Meanwhile, another local providing support to frontline workers is Social Empowerment Education Program Director Chantal Khan. She says the suffering is tragic.
I live right near the main road, and we count now the number of ambulances that run past the house every day, and you're looking at about 8 to 10 a day going in this direction, and your heart just breaks because someone's grandparent, someone's elder is being taken and rushed to the, you know, FAMET centres at the moment, and it's really devastating.
Hundreds of food packs have been going to vulnerable people thanks to the generosity of New Zealanders.
We also have very kind donations coming in from several places, including New Zealand. And we want to thank the New Zealand community that have sent funds for ration packs. There's a lot of potential for gaps to be opened up. So marginalized, vulnerable groups, the elderly, the disabled, you know, they fall through the gaps. So we try to make sure that we're catching as many as we can.
Here in Aotearoa, President of the Fiji Goodmit Foundation, Krish Naidu, has also sent thousands of dollars worth of food parcels to Fiji. He says it's taking a toll on people's well-being.
There is a humanitarian crisis of food in Fiji, you know, where people are really struggling. Hence why maybe some people are moving about looking for food due to COVID, borders being closed, and not everyone is getting the government financial support. But at the same time, we're also worried about the level of mental health issues our people are facing back home. We are aware of a number of suicides that have happened recently. So we're just telling people, you know, that support each other. And we're also doing our best to support them from here.
Despite calls for a lockdown, the Fiji government are adamant on focusing on vaccinations and keeping the economy afloat. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says she cannot influence Fiji's response, but can only offer support.
Ultimately, as with any nation, it's up to the political leaders to decide how they wish to respond to a COVID outbreak. Same for New Zealand, same for any country. Of course, you know, we are here and ready and willing to offer any support or advice that we may have had from our experience.
In a statement today, the Ministry of Health said it's aware of the demand on health services in Fiji and will be looking to see how they can provide assistance. A spokesperson says discussions are underway about the possible air transfer of a patient requiring hospital-level care. No formal request has been received by them at this stage.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has used his visit to Tahiti's main hospital to appeal for more people to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The French leader is in French Polynesia on an official visit that has been put off multiple times over the past 2 years, while France is being roiled by protests against his policies to contain the pandemic. My colleague Walter Zweifel has been following developments and joins me now. So what prompted the initial delays to this visit, Walter?
The initial plan was for him to visit in 2019 and hold a summit with Pacific leaders, just as Jacques Chirac did back in 2003. But that was put off without an explanation to 2020. However, last year COVID struck and everything was postponed. The summit with Pacific leaders was held online just before he left Paris for the Tokyo Olympics and now for French Polynesia.
And so what are the key elements of this visit?
What stands out is that he visits outer islands. He made an appearance at the Tahiti hospital on arrival to deliver his vaccination message, something that is aimed as much at his home audience in France as it is to locals in Tahiti. He's been to the Marquesas as the first French president ever and to the small atoll of Manihi to launch an energy project highlighting the challenges of climate change.
Now, the Marquesas have been pushing for UNESCO World Heritage status. How's that going?
This project has been in the pipeline for many years. Mr. Macron has told locals that he will support a campaign for it to be added to France's UNESCO heritage. This is, of course, welcome news for the mayors there. The bid has not had unanimous support, though. A descendant of the last queen of Nukuhiva wrote to Mr. Macron saying the archaeological sites there were tapu and therefore protected against any type of financial exploitation. To notice that a couple of years ago, he rebuffed the French Polynesian bid to make the Ori Tahiti traditional dance part of the UNESCO heritage.
Now, less than a month ago, France held a roundtable on the nuclear legacy in Paris with many delegates from Tahiti. Is this visit a follow-up to that?
The nuclear issue is complex and quite entrenched. The roundtable was boycotted by the main test veteran groups and the pro-independence opposition. They said any such discussion should have been held on neutral ground, that is at the UN in New York, and it should be part of the decolonization debate, which France refuses to acknowledge and join.
And has he met these groups in Tahiti?
Yes and no. On the eve of his arrival, the French High Commission, which is in charge of public safety, issued a four-day ban on demonstrations by these groups. However, they defied the order and some of them lined the Tahiti roads used by the presidential convoy. It cannot have escaped him that there is a strong movement trying to hold France to account for these tests.
And what are the contentious issues in this regard?
Well, generally, there is an expectation that France should admit guilt for the damage caused to so many people's health. But France has refused to apologise. Instead, it acknowledges that the atomic tests in French Polynesia allowed France to become a global nuclear power. Another key point is compensation of victims, an issue which has dogged relations for many years. Plus, there is the clean-up of the test sites, which are still military no-go zones.
And compensation payments? Who gets that?
The criteria keep shifting as France has tried to adapt the law to the real situation. The law was initially too tough for claimants to succeed. It was loosened, which then clashed with other acts and was again amended. To note here is the fact that until 2010, when the law was brought in, France insisted that its tests were clean. France also says it has always been upfront about the fallout. Critics, however, say they've been lied to, and by the time France began its weapons tests back in 1966, it was known that the fallout posed risks.
Mr. Macron has been meeting the French Polynesian president, Edouard Fritsch. Has the nuclear issue been raised at all?
Well, I imagine it has. They both took part at this roundtable in Paris a month ago. However, the demands for compensation are not pursued with any visible firmness. By contrast, the Social Security Agency is vocal in its demand for France to compensate it for about $1 billion in outlays for cancer sufferers believed to be the result of such tests. Now, interestingly, when Mr. Macron was running for the presidency in 2017, he said he was in favour of paying such compensation. And also, interestingly, the French government this month said that the claim was legitimate. Whether that will translate into any money, we'll have to wait and see.
And what are the opposition saying about all of this?
Well, there's a deep dislike of France's policies on the nuclear legacy. In 2018, the pro-independence party and the main church referred Mr. Macron and all other living French presidents to the International Criminal Court for alleged crimes against humanity. And reacting to Mr. Macron's arrival in Tahiti and the ban on these protests, one of the senior leaders said the presidential visit had nothing to do with the local people, but was just staged as part of Macron's campaign for next year's presidential election.
The parents of an asylum seeker murdered in Australian offshore detention on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea are suing the Australian government and the security contractor of the centre over his death. The 23-year-old Iranian Reza Barati was beaten to death during a riot in February of 2014. In 2016, two former workers of the detention centre were convicted of his killing, but given lenient sentences. One of the men has since escaped prison and is still at large. Reza Barati's parents, Farideh Baralak and Torab Barati, are claiming their son was murdered because of the negligence of the Australian government and the security company G4S Australia. A spokesperson for the Refugee Action Coalition in Australia, Ian Rintoul, says since Mr. Barati's death, other court cases have established some strong precedents in this regard. I spoke with Mr. Rintoul and began by asking him what was in the court action.
Well, the action's claiming that Reza's killing was ultimately due to the negligence of the Australian government, and that his killing has had psychological consequences and mental health consequences on the family, and the government, the Australian government, is being sued, for that psychological and mental health damage, to the family. But ultimately, of course, it's going to hang around the actual killing and the negligence of the government and G4S, which was the detention operator at the at the time, on their negligence and their implications in the killing of Reza.
And in terms of justice for the actual killing, someone has been convicted. Just refresh my memory.
Look, the two people were convicted, but there were very big questions that hung around that particular trial. One of the people did some time in a jail in Manus, but sort of one of those things miraculously escaped and is now at large somewhere in Papua New Guinea. It's assumed the trial at the time seemed like very much a just a put-up job, a smokescreen, to cover the realities of the number of people, including a couple of New Zealanders, actually, that are allegedly involved in the in the killing at the time.
And so timing-wise, this has just been filed now. Is that happening in the coming months? Is it?
That's right. I mean, the actual case now has been filed in the Supreme Court. In Victoria, I mean, these things, take time anyway. I think there's been a number of cases which I think, in terms of legally, have established very clearly that the Australian government, was responsible and remains responsible for the detention centre on Manus Island. So those kinds of connections, I think, and the legally has established without any legal doubt that the Australian government, was responsible for establishing the detention centre, for the maintenance, and was responsible for what happened inside there. So there have been some other cases that have established that, and I suspect that's what's given the very, sort of direct means for the Reza's family to take this action.
Where are we at in terms of that whole offshore detention system put in place by Australia? Are they all closed down now? How are things looking in, and how the people that have been part of that system, how are they being treated in Australia?
Well, it's a big question. Manus Island is closed, but you've still got about 130 people who are in Papua New Guinea, most of them in Port Moresby at the moment. Of course, Nauru, the detention centre, is still open with a similar number of people, still on Nauru. The vast majority of people who were in Manus and Nauru are now, in Australia, but they're not in Australia as refugees. The government is insisting they cannot be permanently resettled here, so you've got around 1,800 people who are in the community, but on bridging visas, very temporary arrangements. Some still in community detention, and you've still got about 180 people who are actually from Matasanuru, who are in detention centres now in Australia for the last 2 years. So it's very, very far from resolved, the whole issue of offshore detention and the treatment of people who were sent offshore.
Vinaka Ian. And that's Pacific Waves for today. Remember, you can listen to us free on Apple, Spotify, iHeart or any podcast platform. And if you're using Apple, please leave us a rating and review so others can also find us. Until next time, bon miha.